Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. I want to play something for you here. It's not a new record. In fact, it's pretty old, but it's an album I used to love. I still do, but I haven't listened to it in a long time. Anyway, listen to this. That was a surprise hit record in the 1980s called Le Mystère des Voix Bulgares, The Mystery of the Bulgarian Voices. It was a choir of Bulgarian women singing arrangements of old folk songs, and for a while it was a kind of a signifier in the rock world that you were, you know, cool or whatever. People like Robert Plant and Peter Murphy and Kate Bush were all fans. Anyway, like I said, I haven't listened to this record in quite a few years, but yesterday I put on the new album by the British producer and singer Ebony Bones, or at least that's what I thought I was putting on. But this is what I heard. And for a brief moment I'm thinking, it's too long to be a sample. Did somebody screw up and put the wrong record in here? But then this happened. Okay, so it is the Ebony Bones record, and making a pretty strong first impression, too. Ebony is here with her band to play live for us today, and her blend of electropop, punk, and soul is pretty irresistible. We'll also listen to an even older record that won't go away. Leslie Gore's It's My Party. It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To is a refrain that is still echoing in a lot of today's pop music, and we'll find out why. And as long as we're talking about today's pop music, you'll be mine and I'll be yours. Oh, I know since yesterday, yeah, is everything has changed. You might not know Butch Walker's name, but you certainly know his sound. That's because the singer, songwriter, and producer has worked with some of the biggest hit makers of the last decade. Pink, Katy Perry, Weezer, Keith Urban. He produced this latest song from Taylor Swift. He's also led his own bands for more than 20 years, and a new documentary sheds light on Butch Walker, the frontman. He's also set to release a new EP next week, and Butch Walker joins us here in the Soundcheck studio. Butch, welcome.
Glad to be here. How are you?
Good. So the film's called Out of Focus, but it puts you very much in focus, which is sort of a rarity since you've been, you know, in the music scene, more of a behind-the-scenes
right,
guy, it
like
seems.
Pulling the levers behind the curtain.
Pay no attention
yeah,
to that
exactly.
man behind the curtain. And I understand you had a little misgiving at first when the documentary team came to you and said, we want to film you.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's obviously, I've been doing this for a long time and I've obviously been making my own music forever and touring and have a great fan base and it's a wonderful family and I don't like messing that up. And I thought that when some guys came to me and said, hey, we want to make a movie about you. And I was like, well, that sounds awful and boring and I don't feel like I'm not Prince. It's not going to be that interesting, you know, or mystical. So I guess I was apprehensive at first, but when they ended up putting something together months later and they sent it to me to see, I was really shocked. I was very surprised with not only how well they did with it, mm-hmm. but just the subject matter and the rawness of some of the interviews, because they went to my family, my parents, my then living father, and interviewed him. Very emotional mm-hmm. Piece in there about him. And you know, if anything, this will be a nice piece to have for my family if those guys didn't do anything with it.
Right.
And then they started getting it in film festivals, and then now it's screening in all these cities, and I don't know, it's interesting. I can't watch it.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, just watching an hour and a half on yourself is a little nauseating. But you know.
Well, what's one of the things that's kind of funny about it is there are people, including Jake Sinclair, the guitarist.
Bass, yes.
Bass. Mm-hmm. Who, when they ask, you know, describe Butch Walker, they're like, oh, yeah, right. how do I do that?
Yeah, there's a lot of pausing. And,
well, there are at least three Butch Walkers. I mean, there's you as a family man.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's you as the producer and as the singer-songwriter. And, you know, it seems like you try and keep those two sort of distinct and separate.
Absolutely. Church and state.
Yeah.
It's very, you know, it's hard because I think a lot of people that end up doing, let's say, get successful as a producer and a writer for other people, they were probably most of them were artists at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just got frustrated and gave it up or realized, oh, the money's in the other job. Honestly, and I know it sounds kind of silly for me to say, I love making the money from that, but I don't care about it. Like, it's not as much as I care about making music and as much as I have. And I think a lot of people that don't know that might think, oh, that's funny. You sing too? I mean, I heard that so many times over the last 10 years, people saying, you know, you do your own music?
Yeah.
Like they're really surprised.
Well, in the film, and again, the movie is called Butch Walker, Out of Focus, we follow you and your band of the time, the Black Widows,
yes.
making the 2001 album, The Spade. And on that album, there is a song called Synthesizers, which is your ambivalent take on your own industry, it seems.
Yeah, and especially my own disgruntled relationship with current and modern music that I have to make sometimes and that maybe I don't want to make for myself. So it was a pretty fun song. That was actually Jake Sinclair, my bassist, and he's also my engineer in the studio. He came in with that song idea, and I was like, dude, I've got to have this song.
And this is the result. This is from Butch Walker. It's called Synthesizers.
Everybody's writing songs with synthesizers, but I don't have a synthesizer. I can still get down like Duran Duran in 1985. I didn't name my band after an animal. I don't have any feathers or neon clothes, but I can stay all night like Sacagawea in a paint fight.
Synthesizers from my guest Butch Walker. He is the subject of the documentary film called Butch Walker, Out of Focus, available via video on demand and iTunes. So this is you as singer and songwriter as opposed to the producer of hit songs and stuff. And as you were saying before, you try and keep those separate, church and state.
Yeah.
But church and state sometimes, whether we want them to or not, find, you know, ways to kind of influence each other, let's say. Have you had...
Yeah. Well, of course. I mean, I've been making my own records way before I ever stumbled, and I say stumbled heavily into the producing and writing world of other artists. It really happened by almost a fluke. And
how did it happen?
Well, I was producing I was always fascinated with doing everything, you know, learning not only be the guy who performs the songs he wrote, but also learn how to record them and produce them in the studio and work the gear. And I was always into that stuff, very hands-on with that kind of stuff growing up. And so when I was making everyone else's records in town, whenever I was not on the road, I would go into the basement and make local bands demos. And a couple of those bands ended up doing well with that. And then more importantly, my first record that I did for my last band, which was called The Marvelous Three, we were late 90s, kind of alt rock thrown into that mix. But I did a song and it became a top five hit, and all these labels started calling me saying, we love the sound of that. Who produced it? And well, I did. Who recorded it? Oh, I did. who wrote it? I did. So they started asking me to do it for their artists. And then it just from there, it snowballed into this day job that I didn't expect to happen, but I'm glad it did.
And it was because of, I assume it was Freak of the Week?
Freak of the Week, yes.
Was the song that
was hit, yeah. Yep.
I spend a lot on all the clothes that I got, cause all the geeks that I meet, they all look cooler than me. But what to do when they're all looking at you, cause you're the Freak of the Week, cause you're on the TV.
We're speaking with Butch Walker. He is here with us on Soundcheck. His film is called, the film about him is called Butch Walker, Out of Focus. Peachtree Battle is the EP that's coming out. I want to go back to the film and something you said in it. Let's hear a clip. This is you talking to the British journalist Philip Wilding of Classic Rock magazine. He asks you, people have bigger hits with your songs than you do. Does that annoy you? And this is the response.
I loved it because I was like, well, this is great. If I can figure out how to do this, then I can do whatever I want with my own,
songs.
Because
yeah.
A lot of people like in the industry just assume, they're like, well, you know, oh, it's, I don't know why that guy gives away his best songs. And it's like, well, there's a difference to me between a good song and a hit song.
That's from the film Butch Walker, Out of Focus. And to me, that's the pivot point for the whole movie. It's like... There's a difference between a good song and a hit song.
Yes,
Do you know that difference when you're writing? Do you know when you've written a song, hit, good?
I think so. And you know, no one can gauge a hit these days. It's sometimes a happy accident. I mean, there's so many great songs that are hits. I mean, you can't deny "Crazy" by Gnarls Barkley. You can't deny the "Tonight We Are Young" by Fun. You can't deny the simple genius of those songs and how catchy and great they are and how they become earworms. And then there's a bunch of other songs that come out that just talk about partying in a club till 3 a.m. And it's like, not my thing, but I realize it can be for others. And maybe there's a lot of people out there that like those kind of songs, and that's why they're so constant hits all the time. But, you know, when you write a song, and to me, I think... at least with my fans, what they appreciate, I think, from me the most, and I hope I'm right on this, is that they really like the narrative. They like the storytelling, and to me, it's always been about that. That's my favorite. Songwriters were that way, and you know, you didn't look at a Tom Waits catalog, or look at a Dylan catalog, or even Springsteen's vast catalog and say that all these were hits, because they weren't.
Right.
But I think that's the thing is with if I'm going to write a song that's like, say, loosely based on my you know, a fishing trip with my father when I was young, you're not going to just go pitch that to Katy Perry.
Right.
I mean, it's not going to work. And so I respect the distance between those two, and it doesn't mean that I didn't grow up on AM and FM radio, because I did. So that's why I embrace pop music and I embrace working on it for other people. But I just think for my own, I don't get that much satisfaction by making a super simple song. I mean, it's not art rock, that's for sure.
But there is an art to making a pop song.
There absolutely is.
Yeah. And on the charts right now, and all over pop radio, is this Fall Out Boy song, officially known as My Songs Know What You Did in the Dark, but everyone calls it Light 'Em Up, which is the subtitle. You co-wrote this song. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've done a number of things with Fall Out Boy over the years.
Yeah, we've done a few.
So how did this song get made?
It was interesting, and to the band's credit, you know, they've always written and done everything themselves. Very DIY band for such a big pop act.
Right.
It's very hands-on with the vision, especially, you know, Pete Wentz, the bass player, is the lyricist, and the singer, Patrick, is like the musical genius who mm-hmm. puts it all to puts it all to melody and song and can play every instrument. And then the other guys, Joe and Andy, are insane players too in the studio, really good. So when we got together, we thought, well, we have to have a springboard here for the new record because we don't want this to be anything like they'd done before. Or they didn't want to carry on. They wanted to reinvent themselves a little bit. And I had this song, and the chorus was Light 'Em Up, and honestly, I had written it with someone else in mind, and it was a big kind of
can you say who?
It was a big kind of Rihanna sounding anthem,
uh-huh.
but with a lot more rock and roll to it. And I know that sometimes that's a hard sell because there's not a lot of guitars on pop radio right now. So I thought if we can squeeze this through. And, you know, there's a big heavy metal scream in the chorus saying, I'm on fire, you know. And I actually did that in the studio and had that on the track when I played it for him. And Pete and Patrick both just flipped out when they heard it. And they went, this is the new Fall Out Boy. And we rewrote it entirely, though, to their credit. They rewrote the verse lyrics to make it super, you know, Fall Out Boy and make it more them. Right. And then we built around the track with their instrumentation a little bit, but the song, the impetus of the song was already there.
So you brought them a demo, your own demo
exactly,
of the song.
Exactly. It was a song idea that I had already right. had. And it ended up it was the blueprint for the rest of the record.
The album is called Save Rock and Roll from Fall Out Boy. And this is the song that Butch Walker co-wrote with them called My Songs Know What You Did in the Dark. Fall Out Boy, the song is called My Songs Know What You Did in the Dark, subtitled Light 'Em Up, from their album Save Rock and Roll, co-written by Butch Walker, my guest, the singer, songwriter, producer, subject of the film called Butch Walker Out of Focus, which is available via video on demand and iTunes. You were saying that, you know, they wanted something that didn't sound like all the Fall Out Boy's songs that had come before, and that doesn't sound like old Fall Out Boy. Also doesn't sound like Butch Walker.
Right.
Which is part of the point.
It's kind of a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So in the film, you know, we get to see kind of you as the singer, the songwriter, you with your family, and how closely those two, there's no separation of church and state there.
No.
The songwriter and the family guy are one and the same, it seems.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you have a kid, it changes everything, I believe. And that was where the respect for my father came tenfold when we brought my son into the world 6 years ago, and it just it wasn't about like, oh, I've got to like give up my job and give up music and dedicate my life to being a father. If anything, things just got better and kicked me into high gear with every bit of the, you know, every aspect of my job.
Mm-hmm.
But it also made me, you know, appreciate love more and how and understanding, because they are understanding like you would not believe, because there's not a lot of times I'm home.
right.
And my dad wasn't home a lot growing up either, and it wasn't because he was out being irresponsible. He was working to keep food on the table for his family, and I respect that.
Mm-hmm. Now, your father was, battling illness. I mean, he has the respirator, the oxygen thing. He passed away afterwards, but he did get to see the film before he did.
Yeah. He was the first one to see it, because he was like, you better send me a copy of that. And so I sent him a copy of it when those guys sent me one, and I think he really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
He really enjoyed it. He was obviously embarrassed by his own interviews, but I thought he was hands down the champion when I saw it. You know, he shined in it with his heart.
It's some of the most emotional parts of the movie, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, there's this song that's on the Peachtree Battle EP called Coming Home.
Mm-hmm.
Is that you sort of coming to terms, dealing with all of this?
It is. A lot of that new record is kind of loosely and metaphorically based lyrically on dealing with mortality. And I knew my dad didn't have long, but I didn't know he was going to go when he went. But he lived way past his due date, said the doctor, 4 years past that what they thought. So it gave me a lot of time to, over the last 3 or 4 years, I was coming to terms with it. And I think medicating for me was writing. So I wrote a lot of songs dealing with it, but without using him as the mm-hmm. subject, really, per se, or literally. But Coming Home is one of those songs that sort of is... It's weird because it's sort of a fantasy version of that, where it's a person who is singing the song post mortem after dying in a car accident in a ditch, and then is going through in their post mortem mind all the things that they didn't get to do and wish they would have done, and it's just a little lesson to live life to the fullest like my dad did.
From Butch Walker, the song is called Coming Home.
So I'm a hand dad and I know they cared. My wife and son, there's a box upstairs with his three initials on it. If he should ever come upon it, there's a note saying everything my mouth can't say. To take a look in the driveway for the lights. Cause one day, yeah, I'm coming home.
Coming Home, from Butch Walker and the EP called Peachtree Battle, which is out next week. Butch Walker's been with us on Soundcheck today. The film is called Butch Walker Out of Focus. It's available via video on demand and iTunes. Thanks so much and congratulations on the film and the new EP.
Good time, thank you.
Well, I've cursed, but I've been blessed to watch a lot of trends go out and come back in, though, like the dogs. But that's the best. To know I wasn't crazy and history got lazier since I got born. And now I'm torn.
Coming up next on Soundcheck, we listen to the modern day iterations of a song that just won't quit. Leslie Gore's 1963 hit, It's My Party. This is Soundcheck.
L-U-V, Madonna, Y-O-U, you wanna?
Next week is Madonna Week on Soundcheck as we look back at the pop superstar's now 30-year recording career. Throughout the week, we'll be talking with people like Seymour Stein, who signed Madonna to his Sire Records label, fashion commentator Simon Doonan, music and film critics, and you. Tell us about a moment in your life that was marked in some way by Madonna or her music. You can call us at 866-939-1612 or email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org. That number again, 866-939-1612. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The Swedish duo Icona Pop is best known for their summery anthem, I Love It. But their new single, or should I say, their not-so-new single, might sound a little familiar. It's an updated version of the classic 1963 tune, It's My Party. And this is hardly the first time that that classic bit of pop has shown up in recent hits. Jody Rosen, the pop music critic for New York Magazine, recently wrote about this for the magazine's Vulture blog. He joins me here in the studio. Hey, Jody.
Hey, John.
So tell us a little bit about the deathless Leslie Gore song, It's My Party, the song that refuses to go away.
Yeah. I mean, this is a classic pop hit. It was a crossover hit when it came out in 1963. It was both number one on the pop charts and on the rhythm and blues charts, which I didn't realize. So that's interesting. And it was actually, you know, it was a little bit of a landmark song because it was the first big hit that Quincy Jones produced.
Mm.
But, you know, the thing about it that's so indelible is that it's just, you know, this kind of timeless bubblegum anthem. It's got that teen melodrama narrative in the verses. The girl is hosting a party and her boyfriend leaves with another girl. Boo-hoo-hoo, it's my party, I'll cry if I want to. You know, that is that hook, that chorus is just fantastic, both because it's, you know, it's very catchy, but it's also, it's just so classically melodramatic and sort of kitschy.
And unusually, the song begins with the chorus.
Right.
So Quincy Jones knew he had a classic on his hands when he produced this.
Right, yeah. No, the arrangement is very, very smart in that way. And actually, you know, one thing that I hadn't really focused on, everybody knows that chorus, but if you listen to the verses of the song too, they're very sophisticated songwriting. Like melodically, it reminds me a little bit of Brian Wilson. So it's just a great song.
All right, let's hear a little bit of the original from 1963, Leslie Gore and her huge hit, It's My Party. Leslie Gore, It's My Party. Even within just like 60 seconds, you get the chorus twice. I mean, the verses are really short so that you can get back to that big hook.
Yeah, the verses are, it reminds me actually of a lot of contemporary pop in that sense, because now they say because of short attention spans and the way, you know, radio programming works and the fact that you have snippets for that people download songs and they only get a 30-second snippet, you know, the imperative is to get to the hook right away in today's pop. And so in that sense, this is an ancestor of the stuff we hear in the top 40 today.
Well, more than just an ancestor, we're hearing deliberate echoes of this song. I mean, we already heard Icona Pop. Mm-hmm. But as we, you know, go through the rest of this list, what is going on? Why this song?
You know, I was puzzling over that. I mean, I wrote this piece a couple weeks ago when I just noticed that, hey, this yet another It's My Party riff in a pop song. You know, I have a couple pet theories. One is simply that it's kind of the guilelessness of the song. You know, this really is quintessentially one of these super innocent sounding bubblegum pop hits. You know, It's My Party, I'll Cry If I Want To. It's almost childish emotion.
Yeah.
And I think that that kind of guileless quality makes it perfect fodder for updates that kind of are cheeky and a little dirty about it. So that, for instance, in the Iconopop song, there's some smutty lyrics in there about, you know, in this case, the girl's crying because the party's gone badly. Her dress has broken, and various parts of her anatomy are hanging out. So, and in a lot of the newer versions and kind of glosses on It's My Party, there's that kind of smutty stuff there.
Mm. So the fact that it's so guileless and childlike is kind of a tabula rasa, a blank canvas, and you can paint just about anything on it.
Right.
So what does British pop star Jessie J do with her song, It's My Party?
You know, her song is just partying. This is a big kind of plus size piece of dance pop. It was produced by the great Swedish producers Max Martin and Shellback. You know, she wants to have a big hit with this song, and so she just kind of grabs this old chorus, which is floating around these days, and puts a big fat beat behind it.
That is Jessie J from Britain. It's My Party.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that I should add about that is you hear, I mean, the refrain is, it's my party, I'll do what I want. So it's not that, boo-hoo-hoo, it's my party, everything's gone so bad. It's sort of a, you know, an empowerment anthem. It's my party. I was about to say something I shouldn't say on air. But in any case, there's a number of these songs take a slightly, I guess you'd say, rebellious or at least assertive view of partying and dancing. And so there's that kind of twist given.
Without actually quoting the Leslie Gore song.
Right.
You know, riff.
It's a riff, but not quoting it melodically. That really is, it's interesting to me because this is an example of the songs. You know, there are many, many songs which, because of sampling and, you know, hip hop's endless cannibalizing of the pop songbook,
yeah,
have come back in the form of a breakbeat or a melodic or rhythmic riff. This is a song where it's the lyric. It's that one lyric which is really returning time and time again. And I think it just speaks to the fact that was just, you know, those songwriters, they hit on something.
Right.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Jody Rosen. He's here in the Soundcheck studio, pop music critic for New York Magazine. His article on the Vulture blog about It's My Party is linked on our website. You'll find it at soundcheck.org. Miley Cyrus, much in the news, but let's talk about the music. This song called We Can't Stop, very similar to the Jessie J piece that we just heard.
It's similar in that it, again, is a kind of anthemic, it's a party anthem.
Right.
I happen to love this song. Miley Cyrus is an interesting person at the moment, for sure, in various ways. But this song is, I think, an incredible piece of music. Great production, great lyric. I think it really works as a perfect 2013 pop anthem. But the thing that I notice about this song, I kind of put this in a category that I like to call the dancing on the edge of doom anthem. I think of other songs from recent years, songs like Black Eyed Peas, I Got a Feeling, Britney Spears, Till the World Ends, Kesha's Die Young. These are songs that are they're party hardy anthems, but there's a kind of edge of desperation to them in the lyrics, and often in the melodies and the production, there's a kind of doomy, melancholy undertow. And I think this songs like that really speak to this moment. I don't know whether, you know, I could give you some big pseudo-intellectual pet theory about, the Great Recession or whatever. But the fact is, there are these songs which are kind of bipolar in that they're saying, we're partying, but everything's not so great out there, and we're partying to in an escapist way, not to think about the outside world. And I really hear that in Miley Cyrus's We Can't Stop. And the It's My Party echo in her song, I think, is very much in that spirit. I think it speaks to the fact that in that song, you know, it's a party that ends in tears. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that a lot of people can relate to all the time, but maybe especially in at an anxious historical moment.
Let's hear a little bit from Miley Cyrus's We Can't Stop. You'll hear the kind of lingering echoes of the Leslie Gore song, It's My Party.
It's our body, we can do what we want to. It's our house, we can love who we want to. It's our song, we can sing if we want to. My mouth, I can say what I want to.
Miley Cyrus, We Can't Stop. The chorus here, Jody, sort of like the Jesse J song, is a variant on the It's My Party, I'll Cry If I Want To. So it's our party, we'll do what we want. We get it in the deep voice.
Right, we're not gonna listen to our parents. We don't care what anyone else thinks.
Now, so far, you know, we started with Leslie Gore. We heard Jesse J. We hear Miley Cyrus. What about the guys? Are they getting in on this act as well?
Yeah, I mean, the guys are getting in. I think it's noteworthy that a lot of women are doing it, first of all, because, of course, Leslie Gore is a woman, and this is kind of a classic girl group song, and there's various sort of the feminist messages that are filtering through this music.
You really got to be filtering through to find a feminist message.
Well, I think
there.
In the current versions, not in the Leslie Gore version, yeah. Right? You know, I think it's maybe interesting that they're taking a song which was pre-feminist, very much in its mm-hmm. sensibility, and giving it a much more empowered, you know, message. But there are guys who've been doing their own, you know, It's My Party riffs, and I think in those cases we're back to the kind of comedic. You know, the humorous value of doing something a little bit smutty, taking this old, very innocent and dopey song and kind of sexing it up.
So you're supposed to get the allusion to this 50-year-old song.
Yeah. And it's funny. It's one of these things, you know, I wonder about how many teenagers or, you know, young people who are downloading the song who have heard It's My Party. Maybe the percentage is relatively low, but it's something about the way pop culture works. It's sort of maybe that lyric or that idea has filtered by osmosis through the culture so much that they kind of get the reference even if they don't know the original.
Yeah.
But yeah, in the case of, for instance, Robin Thicke in 2009, the title track to his album Sex Therapy gives the It's My Party a very saucy spin. And Drake used it as well in his hit Take Care.
Let's hear a little bit of both. Drake with Take Care, Robin Thicke with his song Sex Therapy. You'll hear the echoes of Leslie Gore.
It's my birthday, I get high if I want to. Can't deny that I want you, but I lie if I have to. 'Cause you don't say you love me to your friends when they ask you. Spread your wings and baby fly away. It's your body, you can love if you want to. Loud if you want to, scream if you want to. Just let me love you, lay right here, girl, don't be scared of me.
Well, in Robin Thicke's Sex Therapy, It's My Party becomes It's Your Body.
It's Your Body, yeah. What else is Robin Thicke going to turn that into?
And Drake's Take Care, it's My Party, I'll Get High If I Want To. So, again, the kind of variance on this now 50-year-old theme.
Right. This is the 50th anniversary year, so there you go.
We've been speaking with Jody Rosen, pop music critic for New York Magazine. His article on the deathless Leslie Gore song, It's My Party, is linked on our website, soundcheck.org. Jody, good to see you again.
Good to see you, John.
It's my party, couldn't cry if I wanted to. And the more you taunt me, the more I think I'm wanting you. And ever since, you're the prince and I'm the one that's haunting you.
Up next, we hear a live set from the British electropop musician and producer Ebony Bones. Don't miss it, next on Soundcheck. This Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer. The British singer and producer Ebony Bones has a flair for larger-than-life musical performances. Her tendency towards the flamboyant has earned her a spot opening for CeeLo Green a few years back, and her eclectic musical palette has earned her fans on both sides of the Atlantic. We'll hear more about the making of Ebony Bones' new album called Behold a Pale Horse in just a moment, but first, here's a song, Ebony Bones, live on Soundcheck with Warrior.
This is the sounds of Ebony Bones.
That is Ebony Bones, live on Soundcheck with her song Warrior, featuring Jimmy Pallagrossi on our drum kit and Geki Matsuzaki playing the electric guitar, and sounded like a few other Ebony Bones in a black box somewhere providing the backing vocals. And the album is called Behold a Pale Horse. Ebony, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. On the record, that's the bonus track.
That
right?
is the bonus track, yeah.
And it's spelled all in caps with periods. So
that's
do the
right,
letters
yeah.
stand for something?
They do, yeah.
What?
I'm not going to say right now. I mean, it was a track that I had recorded on my debut album, which was not released in the US. And that was from 2009, called Bone of My Bones. And it's one of my favorites, and it's a good one to perform. So I thought it'd make a nice bonus track.
Okay. The album Behold a Pale Horse, I'm told that it's really kind of two parts.
That's correct.
And what's the distinction between the two?
The first half of the album, called Borny Flames, features a lot of children's vocals and choirs. The New London Children's Choir is one of them. And we have a great cover of The Smiths, What Difference Does It Make, which is one of my favourites on the album. And the second half of the album is called When the Battle's Lost and Won, which is a reference to Shakespeare's Macbeth.
Uh-huh. So were these actually written with a production of Macbeth in mind?
It was something that once all the production was finished and the album was complete, it kind of fell into those two separate parts. Hmm. And actually, they're called acts. So Act 1 and Act 2.
Act 1 and Act 2. Now, you have some familiarity with acting, with the theater,
right,
and with TV. You were on a pretty popular soap opera over there in the UK.
I started on stage, actually, doing Shakespeare. And my first experience standing on a stage was with director Mark Rylance. And that was doing Macbeth. I was one of the witches.
Really?
And
how old were you?
I was about 12, 13, and never done Shakespeare before. And it was phenomenal that he had given me that opportunity. And he had quite a sort of punk ethic himself, in that he completely changed the environment of which Shakespeare had originally placed Macbeth, and did his own interpretation of that.
With a 12-year-old witch.
That's so, yeah. Right, yeah. and that was a great fundamental experience for me, and working on stage and having that theatrical background.
And then the Family Affairs was the TV show.
That's
for
right.
A number of years.
Then I went to the small screen.
So did this serve as a kind of a detour away from music? Was music your first love?
You know, I grew up selling vinyl alongside my dad on his market store in Brixton. And, you know, I spent a lot of time as a child just going through vinyl crates. And mm-hmm. My love of artists and music, and most particularly producers, began from there.
So that explains your album. The beginning, the very first sound on the album, is from a vinyl record that was pretty famous back in the mid-80s called Le Mystère de Voix Bulgare,
That's
The
correct.
Mystery of the Bulgarian Voices.
Yeah.
So is that how you discovered that record of Bulgarian singing?
It's one of my favourites. In fact, I play it all the time before I go on stage as a mantra, you know, just to kind of get into the zone before I get on stage. And
yeah.
So I had worked in India alongside members of the Symphony Orchestra of India. And the arrangement was done by Andrew T. McKay mm-hmm. of the Bombay Dub Orchestra, who are phenomenal. And I'd never gone to India before. And once that piece was completed, I came back and I was listening to what I had done, and for some reason that had come out, played over it, and I thought, this is phenomenal, this has to stay.
So the Bulgarian and the Indian sort
yeah.
of coming together. So you produced this record. I mean, all those sorts of decisions were done by you.
That's correct. And track 7, called Breathe, is produced alongside a phenomenal artist called the Mechanical Elephant.
Right.
And we wrote and produced that together.
So there are actually several tracks on this record where you don't sing.
Right.
They're either instrumental or other people, like the children's choir, are doing the singing. Do you see yourself as a writer first, a singer first, a producer first? Do you not split them up that way?
You know, I think it's all about changing people's perspective of music. What's quite interesting to me is that there aren't many female producers who are celebrated in the same way of which male producers are. And it's somewhat, I don't know, it's sort of medieval misogyny in the industry, of which in 2013 seems quite archaic.
Yeah. So without those kind of role models as a woman,
yeah.
who were you listening to?
I was listening to Brian Eno, Quincy Jones, Butch Vig, Nile Rodgers, the list goes on. You know,
right.
I've always had quite an eclectic taste in music, and I wanted to bring all those elements and pay homage to those.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned growing up in Brixton, selling, you know, vinyl records out of your dad's stall there in the marketplace and stuff. Your dad's family, they're from the Caribbean originally,
right? Both my
right?
parents are from the Caribbean, that's correct.
So is that part of what's going on here musically as well?
Perhaps, yeah. I think, I naturally had a huge affinity to punk music, and I think Caribbean, particularly Jamaican reggae music, has its roots in rebel music, and mm-hmm. I think reggae and punk came together with the same kind of rebel music in mind.
Well, and of course, many of the first wave of punks were huge reggae
Precisely.
Fans. Think of the Clash,
yeah.
and here in the States, Bad Brains.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there's some simpatico
right.
going on.
And the first band to take me on the road with them across Europe on tour was the Slits. So that was a phenomenal experience for me and one of my favorite.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Ebony Bones. The album's called Behold a Pale Horse. It's from Book of Revelations, isn't
That's
it?
That's right, yeah.
So
surprisingly, you're like the first person who knows that.
Really?
I can't believe it, yeah.
So is there something apocalyptic
Most
about?
Definitely. The Sonics kind of have that apocalyptic feel about it, or I like to think they do. And it's somewhat of a concept album, although I don't like saying that. But, yeah.
Well, apparently it's two concept albums.
Correct. Well, two parts, yeah.
The two parts, one
yeah.
one for a movie and the other this kind
sure.
of Macbeth-influenced thing. Which half of the record does While the People Sleep belong to?
On the first half, yes.
Ebony Bones with us here in the Soundcheck studio and performing some songs from her album called Behold a Pale Horse. Let's, I should also mention we are shooting video. I am so glad we are shooting video today of all days because Ebony sounds great and you look fabulous.
All right, thank you.
All right, so shall we get back to live music? All right. The song is called While the People Sleep.
Standing ready for the fight.
Once again, Ebony Bones live on Soundcheck with a song called While the People Sleep. It comes from her new album called Behold a Pale Horse. Another live performance here in the Soundcheck studio. You seem born to perform. I mean, even here in a radio studio, you're dancing around and, you know, you've got this real theatrical look. I mean, how important is performance as theater?
I thoroughly enjoy performing. Being on stage is one of my favorite things, and touring as well. It's important because, you know, music, for me at least, is a spiritual language, and you're resonating that energy to anybody who's listening, even through the radio waves. It really is about celebration, and I never really know when my next time I'm going to be on stage, so it's nice to have that celebration and perform alongside people that you love and trust.
I know when you will next be on stage. It's Sunday evening at Brooklyn Bowl, and Ebony Bones performing some of the songs from her new album called Behold a Pale Horse. Ebony, it has been a lot of fun having you and the boys here in the studio with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting us.
That's going to do it for Soundcheck. Next week is all about Madonna on Soundcheck, and we want to hear from you. Call us up with your Madonna moment at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612, or email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org. On Monday, we talk with Sire Records co-founder and chairman Seymour Stein, who signed Madonna 30 years ago. Plus, the band Ockerville River plays a live set from their great new album here in our studio. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, George Wellington, Bill O'Neill, Jason Isaac, and Rick Kwan. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Greta Cohn, and Mike Katziff, with Alex Kappelman, Amy Pearl, and our intern, Alex Martinez. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.